Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, Chuck Morse. Chuck Morse speaks. This is your host, Monday through Friday, noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, here at Cyber Station USA Radio Network and our online partners, Blog Talk Radio. I'd like to welcome aboard our affiliate stations, WWPR-AM in Tampa Bay, Florida, KSKQ-FM in Ashland, Oregon, and check out our Twitter page, which is available. Not our Twitter. Well, you can check that out, too. Our Stitches, excuse me. Available on Cyber Station USA Radio Network. It's a free app to download that will give you access to this program anywhere in the world. I'd like to welcome aboard Steve Deese. He's a nationally syndicated conservative talk show host, a columnist with townhall.com. Steve, how are you?
I'm well, Chuck. How are you?
Good. Steve, you have an email here, Modernizing the Republicans. How do we modernize the Republicans in the aftermath of this last election?
Well, Chuck, I think it really goes to something I've written, a piece I wrote for the Washington Times that is out today. And we are speaking a language that is foreign to the culture, meaning that we're talking about values, and the culture is looking for solutions. You know, the exit polling found that a majority of the American people thought Republicans better identify with their values, but Democrats cared more, which to me means they think Democrats have solutions to their problems. So let's take an issue like the Second Amendment, for example. We believe that the Second Amendment is necessary in order to protect the First Amendment and all the amendments that follow it, because an armed citizenry is a check on the potential of government tyranny. The younger generations, the emerging generations, were never taught American history. They do not know that value system. So they see gun control as a solution to senseless violence that may kill women and children in the gangland massacre or a home gun accident. And so what we've got to do is stop running on themes so much of limited government, individual freedom, and instead start running on solutions. Because we believe these things, what do those things actually mean? What are our solutions for people's problems? The other side, and the other side is running on how to govern. We're running on values. We need to run on how we will govern, and then we need to govern accordingly, because when the American people gave us control in the early 2000s, we didn't govern on the things we said we were going to govern on, and instead grew government. So we need to establish credibility with the American people. We need to establish trust with them, and I think that goes along in having solutions to their problems and then acting on those solutions.
Steve, I think that what you're talking about is a dilemma that Republicans deal with generally and conservatives deal with, and why we've lost ground in the culture war, which is that we're not willing to, that they lie, and we're not willing to lie and challenge them on their lies. Now, that doesn't mean that individual Republicans don't lie from time to time. We all do. Everyone, that's part of the darker side of human nature. But I'm talking about a more systemic form of lying. I mean, just this kind of overall big lie, which is, of course, what socialist theoretician Hitler called it in his book Mein Kampf. And when you talk specifically about issues, one of which you just brought up, the Second Amendment, they're dealing with the big lie, which is that somehow it's unable to convince the individual that it's bad to provide yourself with reasonable defense, that's a bad thing. And they've been able to convince people of this through their general cultural control of the education and the media. It is a very difficult thing to counteract. I think that you're right when you say that Republicans, when they do govern, they don't stick by their principles. And also, it's human nature to not believe that someone's lying. And I think that in a sense, in that regard, we're much too nice. I think Mitt Romney was much too nice. You know, the Republican candidates wasted a lot of time listening to these ridiculous ad agencies and spending millions of dollars sending out these stupid false, well, these stupid soft commercials that told people nothing. We didn't learn anything from it. Rather than going out with simple commercials that told people the truth about things that everybody kind of knows about, like this deficit that's looming and what that means, mm-hmm. and that raising taxes is not a good thing. But what you also touched on that bothers me about this whole election is that, you know, you can say a lot of things about Mitt Romney that, you know, he was a very flawed candidate in many ways. But the thing that bugged me was that he was attacked for being a successful man. He mm-hmm. was attacked for being a capitalist. And that resonated with people, and that's an attack on every working man and woman in this country, in the private sector. In other words, we should criticize him and view that there's something wrong with him because he's successful and because he's rich. Mm-hmm. You know, in the old days, we used to honor that. That's the American archetype. That's our contribution to world civilization. I mean, the Greeks gave us philosophers. The Romans gave us statesmen. You know, the English gave us playwrights. America gave us successful CEOs. That's who we are. Mitt Romney fits into that mold, but he didn't defend it. He didn't come out and say, this is good, and this is why every working person in this country, regardless of your level of success, can do better and should emulate.
Well, you said a lot there. Let me try to respond to it. Just a couple different things I'd like to just add on to what you just said. The first is the idea of success and a meritocracy. You know, I did this on my own show last night. I spent an hour talking about Maryland and Rutgers joining the Big Ten, and I use this as an example of free market capitalism, what happens when somebody is successful, they can then reward others. I'll give you an example. Last year, the University of Maryland's athletic department was so far in the red it had to cut 7 athletic programs, which meant eliminating scholarships and opportunities for young people to get an education, and an education that might train them into becoming profitable members of society themselves, and thus more than likely better fathers, better husbands, better wives, better daughters, and mothers, and perpetuating the next generation, right?
Right.
But yesterday, when Maryland made this move to the Big Ten Conference, Maryland was able to acquire the funding now to reinstate all 7 of those sports instantly, which means now more opportunities for other people. Because of the Big Ten's financial success, and it didn't do anything that violated its ethics, didn't do anything that was immoral, didn't do anything that was illegal. It didn't violate any ethical boundary, and outside of that ethical boundary, or within that ethical boundary, I should say, it went for the maximum profit that it possibly could, and because of that, there are families and students in the state of Maryland that are going to be that are going to have opportunities in the next 25 years that didn't exist 24 hours ago. And that is a meritocracy. That's the way this is supposed to work, and I think that's what you're getting at. One of the problems Romney had with articulating this is, frankly, the ideal of the American archetype, CEO, pull yourself up from your bootstraps, that really doesn't exist too much anymore in corporate America. The reality is some of the biggest big government people in this country are in corporate America. They're friends of Mitt Romney. The problem you have with Romney is he wants to make an argument 4 years ago that the CEOs at Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch get a government bailout, but that the assembly line worker at the Chrysler plant in Toledo, Ohio, he doesn't get a bailout. We can't win that argument, Chuck. All right, either everybody gets a bailout or nobody does. But you cannot, in this political environment, you cannot send up a candidate who says Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and Goldman Sachs gets a bailout. But the Chrysler workers in Toledo, in a state you have to win if you're a Republican and win the presidency, don't. You're going to lose that argument every single time. And that's the problem is, of course people are getting attacked for being successful, and it is heinous and it's anti-American, but we're really not sending up candidates that offer alternatives. The last 3 nominees we have had, including the guy that was elected, that was in the White House for 8 years, have all been big government Republicans. They've all been bailout Republicans. They've all been people that really, for the most part, buy into the premise of the left. Romney himself bought into the idea that, well, we can't have tax cuts for the rich, when I don't understand why in the world, how you expect to spread the wealth in this country when you don't free up where most of the wealth is. I mean, let's look at a jewelry store. You got a woman there, maybe a single mom. She's making $9.50, $10 an hour. And she's waiting there. She needs some people to walk into that store and buy that $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 necklace for their wives for Christmas. Now, who's going to do that, Chuck? Poor people? Lower middle class people? Nope. Who's going to do that? Upper middle class and rich people. And guess what? If those upper middle class rich people don't feel like they have the discretionary income to go in there and buy that necklace and they hold on to their money and they don't buy it, guess what? That woman making $9.50, $10 an hour, she's out of a job. That's the way this is supposed to work. That is the message we need to be communicating. It comes down to a simple question I asked once when I was on a panel on MSNBC. And I asked them, I said, hey, everybody on this panel, raise your hand if you've ever been given a job by a poor person. Raise your hand. All my jobs have come from rich people who thought me being their employee would make them their life either easier or richer or both. That's where jobs come from. And I think we need to find ways to make arguments that are very simple like that. And what you can't do it with is corporatist Republicans, people that believe businesses are too big to fail, people that believe, hey, Goldman Sachs gets a bailout and the little guy doesn't. Then it's almost like we're writing the Democrat Party's commercials for them.
Right. And then, of course, they could then turn it on the Republicans and say they're the ones that are responsible for the bailout policies that the left really authored, essentially. During the
I mean,
Bush
look what's going on
and,
right now, Chuck, on Capitol Hill. Look, this
yeah,
is all going
also,
on Capitol
Steve,
Hill right now. I mean, they're all buying
about,
into the soak the rich and everything else. They're perpetuating the Democrat talking points, John Boehner and the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill right now.
No, they are. And of course, you're talking about substance here, and you're quite right. I'm talking more about a stylistic thing that bothers me with the attack on someone for being a capitalist and for being successful. And, you know, kind of the man and woman on the street saying, gee, I don't like Mitt Romney and he doesn't care about people. Why? Because he's successful, because he's rich. That
well,
really
a,
bothers me.
It should bother you. It is anti-American. We know those attacks are coming, which is why our candidates have to be prepared for them and understand that. And you mentioned, you know, I could use this same exact thing, for example, on the issue of Benghazi in the debates. I mean, we were on live doing live analysis as the debates were happening on my show, because my show airs at night, 9 to midnight Eastern. And
right.
I literally just threw my arms up when these Benghazi questions came and watched Romney punt in not one but two debates, just punt. And you know, this is where, yes, the media is biased. Yes, we know the media is against us. Yes, we understand that. Which is why when you know, Bill O'Reilly has the number one show in cable news. On a good night, he might have 4 million viewers on a good night. The last presidential debate had 59.2 million viewers, which means a lot of people watching that debate that have never watched O'Reilly, never watched Hardball, never watched Anderson Cooper, and Romney gets a question about Benghazi in the first 5 minutes. This is his chance to make this case that Obama – that people died and Obama lied. This is his chance to make this case to the American people. He punts, doesn't make the case.
This is what I was getting at also, Steve, with regard to conservatives. Mitt Romney just one of many who are just too nice. You know, they're afraid. They're almost cowed by this kind of liberal Eastern Seaboard establishment view.
That's
that
part
everybody
of it, Chuck. But the other part of it
around.
Is the other. Here's the other part of it. Yeah, that's part of it. Here's the real part of it, though. We really don't want to admit to ourselves. We want these people to win more than they do. We are more concerned about the future of the country than they are. In the end, you know, Jesus said it best, you know a tree by its fruit. In the end, people will act on what they really believe, not what they say, but what they really believe is really how they will act. If candidates like Mitt Romney really thought Benghazi was as bad as you and I do and many of your listeners do, really thought the country's future was imperiled as you and I do and many of your listeners do, they would act on it. They would. Especially when their own self-interest, see that as winning an election, you've spent about $50 million of your own money the last 5 years trying to win. Especially when your own self-interest is at stake. You know, in the end, we can't want these candidates to win more than they do. And if they saw that things were as imperiled as we do, they would act on it. But they do not. And neither do the Republicans in Washington. They just do not think the country is in as much danger and the future is as much in peril as you and I do. For if they did, they would act differently.
Yeah, they've kind of bought into this idea of consensus and compromise, which is you can't make a compromise on basic values. And they do that, and it ultimately we get sucked into their playing field. I mean,
That's exactly
we're put
right.
onto their field, and once you put there, then you know, it's kind of like, which would you rather vote for, the liberal or the Me Too liberal? You know,
yeah.
You might as well vote for the Democrat if that's what you want. I mean,
the last two presidential elections, what we've really had is we've had a primary. We've had two primaries. We've had the Republican primary, where the conservative split and the establishment candidate won, and then you have the Democrat primary in the general election. And that's where you have the old Zell Miller blue dog Democrat wing of the Democrat Party versus the Ward Churchill hard left wing of the Democrat Party. That's what we've had the last two elections. That's what we had with John McCain and with Barack Obama, and that's what we had with Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. It's the Zell Miller blue dog Southern Democrat wing of the Democrat Party versus the leftist progressive wing of the Democrat Party. And that's what we've seen in the presidential elections. I mean, you can give me all the rhetoric that you want. In the end, you know, you can go home every night and say to your wife, I love you. But if you slap her around, cheat on her all the time, ignore her, is she going to buy what you're saying or look at what you actually do, Chuck? We're going to look at what you actually do.
So, Steve, where do we go from here with the Republican Party? I mean, we're looking at, things that I think they should start taking action on now rather mm-hmm. than waiting a year and the next election. We still have the House of Representatives. I hope that they will not, under any condition, allow a ceiling, debt increase, a raising of the debt ceiling, or any tax increases. But what do you think is going to happen?
I think they're going to cave, just like they've caved this entire time. I think they will fund through continuing resolutions all this president's schemes, just like they have this entire time, while at the same time claiming they're standing up to him by not signing his budget, by not approving his budgets. But it's six and one, half dozen of the other. I think that we ought to, frankly, I think Washington is unsalvageable. Particularly with the current crop of people in the leadership there. I think the biggest thing that we can do to modernize the party is to continue doing what we've done the last two election cycles, which is invade primaries around the country. 100 incumbent Republicans around the country have lost in the last two primaries cycles, and we need to be invading primaries around the country. It's the most immediate way to advance our worldview. It's the easiest way, too, because they're lower turnout elections, and it's usually the base of the party that turns out. Doesn't cost as much to win a primary as it does a general election. So we need to be invading these primaries. I think all the time and energy we're spending writing letters and emails to John Boehner, who just wants to get a commemorative smoking jacket from the Obama White House and the Washington Post editorial board for Christmas, is a waste of our time. Stop pouring new wine into old wineskins. Start looking ahead. Find more Ted Cruzes, more candidates like this. Find mm-hmm. more of those candidates to invade primaries with. Ultimately, these people cannot be reformed. They just have to be replaced. No one gets more principled the more they're in Washington, D.C. The culture there is just too complacent and corrupt, and the tree of liberty needs to be refreshed with the blood of bureaucrats and lifelong politicians. And in our country, the way we do that and have casualties is not through coup d'etats or civil wars. We do it at the ballot box, and we need to be doing that in primaries.
That's right. It's a peaceful revolution. Steve, I'm with you on that. I've urged people, you know, whether you're a housewife, you're retired, you're a teenager even, you know, and you have a little extra time to run for office, you know, because even if you don't win, you do get your views out there. They are heard. You
mm-hmm.
do change the culture. And that's a tremendous message. Steve Deese, I want to thank you for joining me. Where can people listen to your show?
You can find us just on our website at stevedeace.com. That's D-E-A-C-E. There's a list of our affiliates, and you can listen online live anywhere in the world.
All right, Steve. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chuck.
All right, take care. We shall return shortly. Okay, I want to thank Steve Deese for joining me. Steve is a nationally syndicated conservative radio talk show host. He's a commentator on MSNBC. He is a columnist with townhall.com. His program is every evening. I think it's 10 till midnight. I don't think he's told me where, but it's syndicated. I'm sure it's available at a station near you, as they like to say in the ad business. You're welcome to join the conversation, 347-327-9849, 347-327-9849, Chuck Morse host of Chuck Moore Speaks, Monday through Friday, noon to 2 p.m. I made reference to this idea of the money spent this last election on both sides for these absolutely asinine and inane ads. That's what bothers me about the amount of money spent, not the amount of money itself, but the fact that it was wasted. I mean, certainly media got rich from it, especially television media. A good example of it was in Massachusetts, the Scott Brown-Elizabeth Warren race. These insipid, obnoxious, insulting commercials on both sides just pouring off of the television set and off the radio shows day in and day out. They must have spent, I think they spent more money than any campaign in the history of our state. And they were worthless. They said nothing. They didn't teach you anything. There was nothing I could walk away from those stupid ads. You know, they've got these ad agency people whispering in their ear and doing their surveys and doing their research, you know, on, you know, branding and whatnot, and saying, well, if you say this, it might appeal to women. If you say that, it might appeal to African Americans. If you say this, it might appeal to middle class people. And so they would do these commercials that I would contend insult the intelligence of most people in this country. They were in, you know, they show these stupid images of Scott Brown or Elizabeth Warren, you know, smiling and interacting with family members and friends. Who cares? I don't want to know anything about these people. Or they show images of their opponent all kind of grainy looking and, you know, usually with their finger half stuck up their nose. You know what I mean? I mean, it's obnoxious. It's insulting. And it was a colossal waste of time. Why didn't they just go out with some simple commercials for once, which simply said, this is what I believe in. This is what my opponent believes in. Here is the difference. Make your own mind up. Why didn't they go out and use this money to expose some corruption? You know, I remember, I think it was years, probably about 10 years ago now, in Massachusetts. Actually, Joe Malone, he ran as a Republican for the state treasury office. He ran he had a pretty decent media campaign. Not that it was by any means something I'd hold up, but it's an example of where people can look to for a campaign. On WRKO, he would run these one-minute spots where he would say, this agency in our government is spending, you know, $50 million on cow farts. You know, I want to change that. And the next day, this agency of government is spending $100 million on, you know, balloon research or something. And he would actually give you some real information about what the government is doing. You know, he would research, and he would have people exposing this sort of stuff. And you'd walk away from that with an improved knowledge of how we govern ourselves, not whether or not we like him, whether or not we think he's got good hair, you know, or whether or not we think his opponent, who cares? You know, I mean, and I don't think people care. I really don't. You know, I think the media is focused on those things, and they're focused on the horse race. But I don't think your average person really gives two hoots, and nor should they. Who cares? What does it do for me? You know, in other words, if the campaign had had a little more substance, if Mitt Romney had only run some commercials that explained in clear and unambiguous terms the condition of this country right now, I think he should have won easily. He could have explained what it means to have a $16 trillion debt. You know, sure, you might like Barack Obama as a person, and yes, he seems like a very nice fellow, but is that what we want to elect as the leader of the free world? You know, why not elect a movie star? I mean, I suppose they did in the case of Ronald Reagan, but Ronald Reagan ran on a very, very clear record. I mean, that was different. And my point is that, you know, people ultimately don't care how nice a guy or how nice a girl someone is. You know, they would take a look at the condition of the country. They would take a look at how that's going to affect their pocket, how it's going to affect their wallet, how it's going to affect the security of the country so that they don't have to have their sons and daughters going off to wars. You know, how it's going to affect their freedoms? I mean, are they going to have the right to function in a school or in a workplace without having government agents, you know, charging them with crimes because they might have said something wrong or looked the wrong way? You know, in other words, how do these things affect you as a person? And how does it resonate with your idea of your own sovereignty as a person, as a family, and your own destiny, which is, of course, what this republic of ours is supposed to do. It's supposed to provide a protection so that we can then have our own individual sovereignty to the maximum degree possible. And I think that if that had been done, we would have much more clarity today. Instead, we didn't get that. We got personality. And the result is that we elected Obama, and I think most people in this country, including most people who voted for him, feel a sense of depression over it. It's not just me. I mean, admittedly, I am depressed about it. But there is a sort of a kind of a damped down feeling. Now, I made reference with Steve Deese to this phenomena of the left lying, that they ran a campaign of lies. And it's not so much that they specifically ran a campaign of lies, it's that they always lie, because you have to lie to be on the left in order to support a set of beliefs that no one would accept if you told them the truth. Now, it's not, and by the way, I can personally attest to this in that probably as well as anyone, I've been doing radio now for 10 plus years. And in that period of time, I have interviewed I've spent well over 1,000 hours, probably more close to 2,000 hours, talking with and interviewing and debating people on the left. And I can tell you from my experience, and my experience, I would argue, is pretty considerable, it is a constant effort to sort through the lies. And those are only the lies that you can discern. It's not even the ones that they get by you. And the fact is that it is impossible to really detect the level of lies and the intricacy of the lies, because the entire edifice upon which they sit, the scaffolding, the building, the institutional aspect, is all based on lies. And so you have essentially, you're discussing an issue with someone who actually is in a much superior position than you, because they are free to lie. They can say anything they want, practically, and do anything in order to further the agenda. They don't feel constrained by stating simple truths. And so they have an advantage. It's kind of a home court advantage. It would be like two basketball teams playing a game, and one of the teams doesn't have to worry about cheating. You know, they have a home court advantage. And that's the way the game is rigged. You know, I mean, why do I say this? Am I suggesting that conservatives don't lie? Of course they do. Individual conservatives lie. Everyone lies from time to time. That's part of human existence. It's a normal, darker side of our nature sometimes to lie. Every single person listening to this program, every person who is alive today, who has ever lived, has at various times in their lives engaged in lies. It's just, you know, and there are some cases, of course, where it's justified. You know, the Torah tells Jews and the rest of the world that it is okay to lie if it means saving your life or saving the life of another person. You know, I mean, if you have like a Nazi knocking on the door and you're hiding Jews in the closet and they say, do you have Jews hidden in this house? It is okay to lie to them and say, no, I don't, in order to save their life. So when you're, you know, they call that in Hebrew, pekuach nefesh, to save a life. It is okay to say anything you need to say to save your own life and to save the lives of other people. But beyond that, it is not permissible under Judaic understanding and under Christian understanding to lie. That doesn't, again, mean that people don't do it. You know, and there's a difference between lying and marketing. I'll get into that in a minute. We're going to take a brief break. By the way, you're welcome to join the program. 347-327-9849. I'm going to be off tomorrow and for the Thanksgiving holiday and the following Friday, so I just want to take this quick opportunity to wish everybody a good Thanksgiving. You know, wear loose fitting clothes so you can eat a lot, I suppose, and have a nice time. We shall be right back. I'm going to take a brief break. You're listening to Chuck Morse Speaks. Again, I want to thank Steve Deese for joining me this afternoon, National Syndicated Radio talk show host Chuck Morse, Chuck Morse Speaks, and I'm talking about how the left lies. Again, to define what a lie is and when it's appropriate, I focused on that briefly. There's the concept of pikuach nefesh. It's okay to lie if it means saving a life. Then there are the shades of lies that we all engage in from time to time, which are not necessarily okay, but they're not flat-out lies. You know, they don't quite cross the threshold. And those things include such matters as, let's say, you're composing your resume because you're looking for a job, or you're composing a letter to, you know, to promote yourself for some reason. You're not necessarily going to put in there the bad stuff, or you're going to de-emphasize it, and you're going to maybe put up in the front of the resume the good stuff, and maybe, you know, kind of pump it up a little bit, inflate it. Now, there's a line you can cross, in which case you will be lying if you put outright falsehoods in there, or if you exaggerate something to the point where you're lying about it. But, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about more this sense of marketing that every single person does every day. When you walk out of the house, you try to put your best foot forward. You try to make the best presentation you can in the rest of the world. I mean, if you're walking down the street and somebody, you know, at night, and you think of you might be in danger, a mugger is coming up, you know, you're going to be scared to the point where you might soil your underwear, but you try to look strong. And even though you don't feel that way, because you think that by looking tougher, you might be in a better position to defend yourself or to get out of there. You know, is that a lie? I mean, I suppose it's dealing with the realities of a situation. You know, it's creating an opinion that eventually could maybe become true. So we all do those things. I mean, another example is like, and I'm speaking here, you know, I mean, is that you may not necessarily impart bad news to your spouse right away. You know, you might wait until your spouse is in a better mood, or you might wait a few hours until you've had a chance to think about the situation so that you can figure out how to discuss it in a way that is less impactful. Now, it doesn't mean you should lie about it. You're not, if you lie about it, then that's wrong. But it's not necessarily a lie if you decide to present the issue in a certain light, or at least, you know, present it at a certain time. Everyone does that. You know, that's a, you know, it's just a part of editing, if you will. I mean, that's what an editor does when you write a book. You know, they go through it and they make changes so that the message looks better and it reads better and it's more correct. You know, that's it's just, I suppose you might say it's editing. My point is that that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about lies. On the left, you have more than just those sorts of conventional matters, and it's more than just opinions. It's more than just engaging in discourse based upon, unknowably based upon false information. It is outright lies. And I can tell you this from experience. It's happened to me over and over and over again. Just about every time I've talked to liberals or people on the left on my program and in my own family on issues of substance, they will easily and effortlessly and seamlessly slip into lies. Doesn't mean that they're less honest as people. I'm not claiming that. I mean, they are just as honest or dishonest in their personal life and in their business life as anyone else. I'm talking here about philosophy. I'm talking here about political discourse. I am talking here about social discourse. In those realms, when they delve into such matters as politics, they will lie and do as a matter of routine. It's not a matter of exception. Again, you can point to lies that were engaged in by conservatives and by Republicans, if you will, this past election and generally, and be right about that. My point is twofold, however. When conservatives engage in those sorts of lies, political lies, those are exceptions to the rule. Those are diversions from the usual course. You'll usually find that conservatives are more honest in their beliefs, but that doesn't mean that they may not occasionally engage in a lie. On the left, it is always based upon the big lie, and then once in a while they'll tell the truth, but only if it situationally helps their argument. They are coming at the issue from a position of a lie. And the second issue I would point, there are two aspects of this, is that the conservatives generally don't concoct these big, big lies. You know, that's a left-wing thing. I mean, these colossal lies to get entire nations and societies to embrace something that they might not otherwise embrace, like war, like huge taxation increases, like depressions, like economic systems that lead to, you know, the culling of private property, you know, institutions that do this, they're based on lies. As it is construed today, I would argue that the Federal Reserve System is based upon a series of lies that were originally propagated by liberals back in the early part of the 20th century. These are, you know, ideas that become institutionalized. I would argue and have argued that Darwinism is a lie, but it's a big lie that has become so pervasive and so accepted that it becomes impossible to challenge it, and that if you do try to challenge it, you're squashed. You know, but when you peel away the onion, you realize that these things are based upon lies, or certainly unprovable ideas that are presented as science, which itself is a lie. You know, it's more of a philosophy than it is a science. You know, that's more than marketing. Those are big lies, and you have to take a look. And this is something that's fascinated me since I've gotten involved in talk radio, debugging myself from some of the big lies that are promulgated, taking a look at the motivation behind these lies. Why do they do this? Why did they concoct this? Because I do believe that at some point or another, someone sat down and figured this thing out and figured out how to market it to the public. Now, why do I say that the left as a philosophy is engaged in this lying stance? It's because no one in their right mind, maybe with some minor exceptions, would accept voluntarily what it is that the left is asking people to do. So they have to lie in order to get something happening for them. What is it that they are asking people to do? They are asking people to sacrifice and surrender their own abilities and the fruits of those abilities. They're asking them to surrender their property. They're asking them to surrender their capital, their money. They're asking them to surrender portions of their freedom to choose matters of education, matters of how they deal with their own health care, matters of how they deal with their means of communicating with other people, how they trade with other people on a professional and personal level. They're asking people, in so many words, to surrender these things to the centralized state, which is controlled by them, the enlightened elite. Now, in order to get people to do that, because it obviously is a contradiction in human nature, since we do not want to surrender these things, we want to control these things to the maximum degree, which, of course, is the conservative principle. They have to engage in lies. They have to engage in subterfuge, in deception, and they do it in a very skilled and very elaborate way. Anyone who has spent any time debating with someone on the left, you come to realize that they almost speak in their own language. It is not a direct language. It is a dishonest language. It is a language filled with euphemisms. It is a language filled with indirect terms that have various, at times, multiple meanings that can mean different things to different people in different settings. And it is extremely elaborate and baroque, actually. And it is an artifice of communication that is deliberately indirect and secretive. Now, I'm not suggesting that most liberals and most people on the left are conscious of this. I don't think they are. I think that this is something that becomes a conditioned part of their psyche at an early age. I don't think most people actually on the left have any particular beliefs. Many of them hold conservative beliefs to the degree that they hold any. They have embraced these ideas, these authoritarian ideas, because it's fashionable, because it is conformist, because it is the path of least resistance and the most reward. It is becoming a part of the beautiful people. And there's also implicit in that an understanding, at least under the surface, that to not conform to these ideas involves a certain level of punishment. And that punishment can be quite real and quite harsh. That can deal with people's livelihoods. It can deal with people's ability to function. And then, of course, in the case of leftist authoritarian regimes, when the left really does take the high power in the total and radical sense, like Soviet socialism or Nazi socialism, it can mean the end of your life, and did. Anyway, so you know, most people conform, but there is a hardcore aspect to this conspiracy that is fully conscious and fully witting, and that is engaging in this massive, elaborate, international, Byzantine web of lies. Now, again, this past election is a perfect example of that. And it is too often the case that conservatives do not know how to respond to this. I don't know how to respond to it when it happens to me. You know, I mean, I'll use an example just the other day. Actually, it was just yesterday on this program. And I say this with absolute respect for David Pakman, who is a progressive radio host that comes on this program occasionally. And I've been listening to his program. He's a young man. He's probably no older than maybe 20, probably in his early 20s, just starting out. He's very, very good. But he has already mastered much of the ability that is quite prevalent on the left to lie, but to do so quite skillfully. And in fact, what's interesting about David is that he actually talks about this on his own program. You could check it out. Go to his website, davidpakman.com, check out some of his YouTubes, and you will hear him explain how he's learning. These guys must all go to communist school. I don't know how they do it. But it's how he's learning how to engage in lies, essentially, even though he doesn't call it that. How to respond to a conservative. You just forge forward and change the subject. You don't talk here. You don't talk. You mean all these strategies. It's how to lie. I mean, this is something that they learn. Well, on my program yesterday, he engaged in this big lie. And, you know, the thing is that conservatives don't know what's going on, including myself. And it's amazing. And maybe I'm not stupid either. But even after all these years, it is natural and it is normal for people to trust other people, even if they think they are liars, because we just do. It's part of the human psyche. We get sucked into it and we go along with it. And in the case that I'm referring to yesterday, it was that I brought up my contention that one of the things that I disliked about this past election was, one of the things that bothered me was the fact that the Liberal Democrats and their various friends, as a part of the campaign against Mitt Romney, attacked him personally for being wealthy and made this into an issue as if this is something that people should view as a negative and that this is proof that he doesn't understand people, you know, and real people, and he doesn't, you know, that we should not have somebody that's that rich. Now, I brought this up because I wanted to discuss why this bothered me. And David Pakman, as a good liberal, he did not want to have that discussion because he understood at some level that him, not personally, but as a representative of the left point of view, would not come out on the good side of such a discussion. So he engaged in an act of subterfuge. It is a talking tactic that constitutes, I would argue, a form of lying that is typical of the left. He decided to turn the tables and do what you might call in basketball, dribble the ball, you know, run down the clock by denying that the Democratic Party and that liberals had done this. No, they didn't do it. I'm lying, he tells me. This is not true. So we spent the majority of the conversation arguing. I got sucked into that because it attacks me personally. I mean, I heard someone on this program a while back attack John Fund. He's a columnist at the Wall Street Journal, saying, oh, he's lying about his charges that there's voter fraud amongst Democrats, without really giving any attribution to what the lie was. So Fund, defending himself and his attack on him personally, he got sucked into the conversation rather than getting into what he was there to talk about, which was the nature of the fraud that he's covered. So we never heard that. Instead, we heard a debate about whether or not he's lying. It's a tactic, and it's a dishonest one. Anyway, so that's what happened yesterday with this conversation. We spent most of the time arguing about whether or not the Democrats had done this. And toward the end of the argument, David Pakman made my case. He then said, yes, I do think that Mitt Romney doesn't care or didn't care about working people because he's rich. Yes, he does. I mean, he kind of acknowledged it, but it was already, you know, we were already toward the end of the program. And then he went on to say, but yet I think John Kerry, also very rich, does care, without really showing me any particular evidence of that. My point is that anyone who debates a leftist or a liberal has to understand that they are very experienced, so many of them are, especially those who do debate publicly, in these sorts of lying tactics. He knew that he was lying. He knows that the Democrats used that against Mitt Romney. It's not even worth discussing. It's not even controversial. Of course they did. I mean, Barack Obama himself did it during one of the debates when it was brought up that Mitt Romney had investments in China as part of his blind trust. Mitt Romney responded by pointing out that Barack Obama also had investments in communist China through his trust, And Barack Obama turned to him and he said, "Oh, yes, but your trust is so much larger than mine." What was he saying? Why would he bring this up? Why is that relevant? Why is that any more relevant than saying, "Oh, yes, but you have blonde hair"? I mean, he brought that up because this was part of the dialogue of the left that Mitt Romney is rich and that that's bad. So, I mean, the evidence is obvious, and it was pervasive. And it did have a lot to do with why people didn't vote for Mitt Romney. I know this because of my own experience in it, because of my own, and it's more than anecdotal. It's because of not just commentators that I heard day after day on MSNBC and elsewhere and Howard Dean and everyone else, but also because of people in my own life, liberals, people that I spoke with at my synagogue, people that I spoke with in my own family who said, "Oh, Mitt Romney is so rich," without explaining exactly why this would be seen as something that's not good. He doesn't care about people. He doesn't like people. So, of course, that had something to do with why he lost. And that's what bothered me. That was my point. You know, you can criticize Mitt Romney. He probably should have lost anyways. There were a lot of things he did wrong. And that's not the issue. And by the way, David Pakman was able to gloat and say, "Oh, well, get over it. He lost anyway." That's not the issue. The point is that it bothered me that this particular aspect of the race bothered me, and it would have bothered me whether he won or lost, by the way, that the main thrust against him was that he was a capitalist, that he made money, and that this was to be connected with something negative, that this is seen as bad. And I think that it's actually a genuine and sincere expression of the views of the left. They do believe it's bad. So I don't see why they won't debate it and come on out. They won't, because it's impossible to defend that position. Now, as I mentioned, I've been doing this program for 10-plus years, and there is an ongoing assault against certainly two groups of people more than others in this country. I mean, there's an assault on a lot of groups of people, but the two groups of people that I specifically want to illustrate here are, well, actually, I'll put it this way. I'll make it three, okay? Very wealthy people, corporations, and people who are believers in God, who are parts of organized religion. The corporations is a very specific agenda to control them, and that's done actually and spearheaded by some of their own people, very wealthy people, who are on the left, as are most of the biggest ones, to stop those who are not. And that is such things as stopping Citizens United, which allowed for people and corporations to get involved in politics in a way that is in their interest, by teaching people generally that there's something wrong with that. And as far as religion goes, this idea, and I've heard it said by liberal commentators, that anybody who takes a political opinion or any religion that takes a political opinion is to be banned because that's illegal, runs against the Constitution. And if they're operating in any public sphere, then that has to be stopped. In other words, it's sort of like the way religions were in Nazi Socialist Germany or Soviet Socialist Russia. They were allowed to exist, but they were state-controlled. And they were not allowed to talk about anything political. They were simply there to wear gold, embroidered robes and walk around with incense and conduct marriage ceremonies and brises and baptisms. Nothing political. And the reason why the left is going after these three groups: very wealthy people, corporations, and genuinely religious people, is because they are sovereign-type people. They are islands of sovereignty, if you will. They are not people who can be controlled by the state. They are not people who are susceptible to the 10 administrations of a state agenda, this idea that, which is the left view of the state, which is that you should surrender portions of your life, your property, your identity, your mind to the state for the good of others. They don't buy it. And therefore, their very existence means that they are standing in the way of this agenda. So they have to be stopped. And that's what it's all about. It's not a matter of, because I've wondered this. How do you explain this hatred for success? It's because successful people are self-made. They're sovereign. That's who they are. Now, if you say this to a liberal, they will lie. They'll say, oh, no, I admire success. Sure they do. They admire it when it's somebody like, the wealthiest person in the world who's also a leftist. After all, their whole enterprise could not exist without wealthy people backing it. No, they don't admire it. They want to have a corporatocracy like Mussolini had, where all corporations are controlled by the state and all states are controlled by corporations. What's the difference? And so I guess that my point here as we reach the end of the program is it's impossible almost to debate a leftist because they lie. And therefore, the best course forward is to simply but clearly articulate truths and to do so continuously and in an ongoing way because they're never going to stop. They have the oldest, Whitaker Chambers pointed out that leftism is the world's second oldest religion. They've been around since Adam and Eve. They were the serpent in the garden. You can be as gods. You can know all truth, all good and evil, just like God. In other words, they view themselves as, since they are gods on earth and they're trying to overthrow God, anything is allowable. And every generation, we have to confront it. And yet, I'm optimistic. This country has made enormous strides because by perhaps divine providence, perhaps by circumstance, we were able to establish the type of republic that more than any in history has fostered conservative values, independence, individual freedom, moral standards that can't be manipulated by the state. And so I'm optimistic, and I hope that we can continue the course here. We should remember that in the American Revolution, it was probably only about 25-30% of the population actually supported it. About a third of the population opposed it, and about a third of the population didn't care. So we are that third. We are the population, us conservatives, who understand consciously and support the very ideals that make us free. And we have to continue the course. We have to promote them. And we have to continue carefully but very firmly to educate people with regard to why we think what we do and why they should agree with us. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a very, very nice Thanksgiving holiday. Eat plenty of turkey. Have a nice time. Get together with friends and family. I shall return, God willing, next Monday at the usual time, noon in the afternoon, Eastern Standard Time. Check out my blog site, Chuck Moore Speaks. My book, which is available on my blog site as a PDF, is The Monkey Trial, Evolutionary Politics in the Post-Traditional Age. And have a very nice weekend. Have a very nice holiday. Goodbye, everybody.